From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
The day repeal passes, I intend to be open for business, legally, in the thirstiest country on earth.
That was Steve Buscemi planning for the end of Prohibition in Sunday's premiere of Boardwalk Empire's final season. Today we talk with the creator of the HBO series, Terrence Winter. He's one of the few people who know which characters will survive. Before killing off a character, he often personally calls the actor to deliver the news.
I actually had called one actor. I said, hey, it's Terry Winter. He said, well, I guess I'm dead. I said, well, you're fine. Your character's dead, but you're okay.
Winter also wrote the screenplay for The Wolf of Wall Street and wrote several classic episodes of The Sopranos.
So, after all is said and done, is this all there is?
And Maureen Corrigan reviews David Mitchell's fantasy novel, The Bone Clocks. That's coming up on Fresh Air, First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The HBO series Boardwalk Empire started its fifth and final season last Sunday. My guest is the series creator and showrunner Terrence Winter. He also wrote many of the episodes. Martin Scorsese is one of the executive producers and directed the pilot. Scorsese and Winter also collaborated on the film The Wolf of Wall Street, for which Winter was nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. He won 4 Emmys for his work on The Sopranos, on which he served as a writer and an executive producer. Boardwalk Empire is about rival gangsters, corrupt politicians, and federal agents in Atlantic City during Prohibition. The series opened in 1920, on the day before Prohibition begins, when Nucky Thompson, the corrupt city treasurer, played by Steve Buscemi, is about to initiate his plan to keep the city awash in bootleg liquor and make a fortune doing it.
Mr. Mayor, friends, fellow members of the city council, as you know, in less than 2 hours, liquor will be declared illegal by decree of the distinguished gentlemen of our nation's Congress. To those beautiful, ignorant bastards.
The new season jumps ahead to 1931, 2 years before the repeal of Prohibition. Nucky Thompson is hoping to use his liquor connections to go legit as soon as Prohibition ends. He's in Cuba, where he's trying to convince the head of Bacardi Rum that Prohibition will be ending soon and Nucky should be Bacardi's U.S. distributor.
Tom Maxime, I have a distribution network already in place. Deepwater port on the Florida coast, agreements with rail lines and trucking companies. The day repeal passes, I intend to be open for business, legally, in the thirstiest country on earth, with Bacardi Rum as my most exclusive offering. Can the two of us come to an arrangement?
A scene from the new and final season of Boardwalk Empire. Terrence Winter, welcome to Fresh Air. So how did you decide that this was going to be the last season, or was it HBO that decided for you?
It was us. It was myself and Howard Korter and Tim Van Patten. Howard, of course, is one of the executive producers and main writers of the series. He actually wrote the season opener. Tim Van Patten, also executive producer and our main director, and he directed the opener as well as many others of the show. We sat down. It was somewhere in the middle of season four when I believe Howard and I had a conversation that we felt inadvertently Nucky's story seemed like it was heading toward a conclusion. Nucky was desperate to get out of this game, get out of this lifestyle that he had concocted for himself. He was already making plans to try to relocate to Florida. And the more we talked about that, we decided maybe we should start thinking about an end point here. You know, for us, the idea of just keeping a show on the air for the sake of being able to have a show is really artificial storytelling, you know. And for us, we felt when we're done, let's be done. For me, as a viewer, I'm always amazed when I'll hear about a show that's on the air, and I'll go, God, is that still on the air? And you can't even wow, that's still going. And I don't want that to be us.
So why did you want to tell the story in the first place about a group of gangsters during Prohibition?
Well, there was two reasons. One very selfish reason was that when HBO gave me the book Boardwalk Empire, which was essentially a history of Atlantic City, they said, you know, why don't you read this thing and tell us if you think there's a TV series in there somewhere. And, oh, by the way, Martin Scorsese is attached to this. So without even reading the book, I said, yes, there's a TV series in this and I'm going to find it. Without even knowing what it was, the chance to work with Martin Scorsese was something I couldn't possibly even imagine, and certainly not pass up. When I went home and actually read the book, there was a chapter about this guy Nucky Johnson, who we later fictionalized as Nucky Thompson, of course, and he was the county treasurer of Atlantic City during the Prohibition years. And Prohibition was really the single event that made organized crime possible. That's where organized crime was born. It made millionaires out of criminals overnight, allowed them to make money to infiltrate other businesses, and it was just an incredible boon to people of that ilk. It was also sort of the flip side of what I had been doing on The Sopranos for 8 years or so. If The Sopranos was sort of an exploration of the end of organized crime, or sort of the waning days of organized crime, the Prohibition years was the beginning of that same thing. And it also, you know, the more I looked at it and read about it, there were so many things in the 20s that were really a mirror to current society. Essentially, the illegal alcohol business is the drug business. I mean, these are basically drug dealers. The fact that we're still debating women's rights, the fact that the Scopes monkey trial, for example, was in 1924. We're still debating evolution almost 100 years later. So I thought, God, what an opportunity to really do a show that holds up a mirror to the current society, and it's 90 years in the past.
So another similarity between then and now is that you've got a lot of people just back from a war. And World War One is the backstory for so much of what happens in Boardwalk Empire, because you have people who, young people who came back damaged by living for so long in the trenches and by having to kill so many people and for coming home and feeling dead inside.
Right.
And not caring if they risk their lives. And I want to play a scene that relates to that. And this is from the first season of Boardwalk Empire. And you wrote this episode. And this is a scene with Nucky Thompson, who's, you know, the boss of Atlantic City. And he's still kind of part corrupt politician. He's the treasurer of Atlantic City and part gangster. He's not full-time gangster yet.
Yes.
And Jimmy Darmody is a guy whose life he feels responsible for reasons too complicated to get into. But anyways, Jimmy Darmody's back from the war. He's young. He's in his 20s. He's kind of damaged by the war. He's working for Nucky, but he's made a big mistake that cost like four or five lives and is making Nucky look really bad. So Nucky is really angry with him. And here's the scene.
Are you that stupid? I have no idea how in over your head you are.
I know it's a lot.
Did I not tell you to slow down? I tried to give you money. I tried to
tell you I'm not a kid anymore.
And killing, that makes you a man?
No.
You got brains, kid. You got a future.
Look, I still got a future. We both do. The war, Nuck. The things I did over there. You live in a trench for months on end, killing the smell of death. Nucky, I'm nothing but a murderer. You know how many times I went over the top? They call me a hero. The truth is, I didn't care anymore. I didn't care.
You're home now. You got a family.
I'm going to hell, Nuck.
I'm not gonna off.
No, I am.
You are not.
Well, I'm 22 years old. I see fellas like Luciano, fancy suit, diamonds.
Is that what you want?
That's what you want, too. That's what we all want. At least I got the gumption to take it.
You'd be very foolish to underestimate me, James. I could have you killed.
Yeah, but you won't. Look, you can't be half a gangster, Nucky. Not anymore. Let me help you.
That's Michael Pitt and Steve Buscemi in a scene from Boardwalk Empire, an episode written by my guest, Terrence Winter, who's the creator of the series. So there's a line in the clip that we just heard where Jimmy says to Nucky, "You can't be half a gangster." That became kind of like a catchphrase. That was a line a lot of people remembered from the series. When you wrote that line, did you think that this line's going to stand out?
No, I really had no idea. It was it for some reason resonated with people, but it really didn't make sense. I mean, when basically what Jimmy was saying was, the low level corruption, the little extortion, election rigging stuff is over. If you're going to survive now, the game has completely changed. Once alcohol became illegal, it was very clear that there were millions of dollars to be made, and there were people who were going to be pulling a lot of triggers in order to make that money. Unless you were fully capable and willing to be one of those people, you are not going to survive. So that was basically it. It's like this is now moving into a level that Jimmy did not think Nucky was comfortable with or capable of being involved in. And of course, the big irony is that when Jimmy tells him you can't be half a gangster anymore, the thing that makes Nucky fully a gangster is killing the very person who tells him that.
Yes, which he does at the end of season two. And you wrote that episode two, and we have a clip of that standing by.
Okay.
So, in the clip that we just heard, Jimmy says, yeah, you can have somebody kill me, but you're not going to. And at the end of season two, after the relationship between Nucky and Jimmy has deteriorated more, and Nucky sets Jimmy up to have a meeting with him in the pouring rain. Nucky's men are surrounding him. and Nucky pulls a gun on Jimmy. And here's the scene Jimmy speaks first.
This is the only way we could have ended, isn't it?
This is your choice, James.
I died in the trench years back. I thought you knew that. So who's gonna do it? Manny? You? Eli?
I am.
My first time I vomited after. 2 days straight. Second time I didn't even think about it.
So stupid.
Just try to make yourself calm.
You had everything going.
Breathe, Nuck.
Your whole life.
You'll get through it. All you gotta worry about is when you run out of booze, and you run out of company. And the only person left to judge you is your...
You don't know me, James. You never did. I am not seeking forgiveness.
Okay, putting a period at the end of that sentence.
I think that was an exclamation point.
Good point. And that was Steve Buscemi and Michael Pitt in a scene from the second season of Boardwalk Empire, a scene written by my guest Terrence Winter, the creator of the show and the executive producer and showrunner. And Boardwalk Empire just started its final season. Did you know when you wrote the earlier scene where Nucky says, "I could have you killed," and Jimmy says, "Yeah, but you won't," that Nucky would end up shooting him himself as time went on? Like, how far ahead do you look when you're writing an ongoing series like this?
Well, I knew that would happen eventually. I just didn't know when. And as the series progressed, it became very clear toward the end of season two that it had to happen then. Going any other way, I would not have believed it. If we're saying that Nucky is now going to be a gangster and is going to be in charge of all these men, for him to let Jimmy off the hook would have just felt like a TV show to me. I would have watched that as a viewer and said, "Oh, okay, they're just trying to keep, you know, they're trying to keep this second lead of the show alive," and you would have lost me. And I think part of what makes the show special for me is that we try to be as true to the characters as possible and let the chips fall where they may in terms of actor deals and commitments and that sort of stuff. We made a deal with ourselves early on The Sopranos that we would never keep a character alive because we liked the actor who portrayed them, because we felt we would never kill anybody. You know, you start to get very close to people, and if you start to let personal relationships bleed into the work, it really colors it in a bad way. So that was the case here. You know, even though I knew how enormously popular that character was, and I really didn't have any idea what we would do after it, it was the right thing to do creatively.
When you kill off a character, isn't there a part of you that feels really bad because you know you're firing an actor?
Yeah, it's the hardest part of my job, making that phone call, you know, putting people out of work. So it's tough. I mean, I've made a lot of those tough phone calls.
You make the phone calls yourself?
Yeah, I make the call before the actor reads it in the script or hears it from somebody on the crew.
Do they know what's coming when they get a call from you? It's kind of like, uh-oh.
Yeah, I actually had called one actor and I said, "Hey, it's Terry Winter." He said, "Well, I guess I'm dead." I said, "Well, you're fine. Your character's dead, but you're okay." I said, but yeah, I mean, that used to be the joke with David Chase. You know, you didn't want to get a call from David as an actor, and suddenly I was in that position as a showrunner, and it was the same thing. But then even, you know, inadvertently over the years, I've called an actor to say, "Hey, I just saw a cut of the episode. You were terrific in it." And I can hear the trepidation in their voice. They think I'm calling to tell them they're getting killed, but I'm actually calling to say, "Hey, you were terrific in the last episode," or "Hey, let's have dinner," or something like that. So I started to learn to preface things with like an email, "Hey, I'll be calling. It's not about anything bad," or, you know, so try to see it from their perspective.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Terrence Winter. He's the creator of Boardwalk Empire, which just started its fifth and final season. He also wrote for The Sopranos and wrote the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Terrence Winter, and he is the creator and showrunner of Boardwalk Empire, which just started its fifth and final season. It's about organized crime and political corruption in Atlantic City during Prohibition. Terrence Winter was also a writer for The Sopranos and wrote the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. What's your exposure to organized crime? Do you have any?
Not really. I grew up in Brooklyn as a child there in the 60s and a teenager in the 70s. I guess kind of by osmosis, you rub elbows with people who are involved in that life, so you can't really
avoid it. I grew up in Brooklyn. I really don't think I rub shoulders with people in that life. I rub shoulders with people in the garment industry.
I bet you didn't realize
grocery
it.
Stores. And
you never know who's standing behind you online. I mean, if you're aware and you know who's doing what and who owns what store and what club and that, you know, the people are around, you know, and I was a little more aware of it, I think, growing up. So, you know, I was interested in it. And, you know, somebody asked me recently, where did it begin for you, the fascination with this? And I traced it back to the movie Oliver, I think from 1968. I watched that and I wanted to be the Artful Dodger. I wanted to be in that gang. And it was just very exotic and glamorous. And then a couple of years later, I saw The Sting.
Be a professional pocket picker?
Pickpocket, yeah. I thought that was so cool. It seemed great. And then The Sting came out, and I became fascinated with con men. And then I started to read, you know, books about the mob. And again, you know, just having been in New York and Brooklyn at that time, you know, it's sort of that stuff was everywhere. So just sort of, you know, soaked it in and was always interested.
So there, depending on what you read about you, you either worked for a butcher that was run by Paul Castellano, who was head of the Gambino crime family at the time, or mm-hmm. you ran for work for a deli that was run by him. Did you work for anything?
It was a butcher shop.
It was
a chain of butcher shops that allegedly was owned by Paul Castellano in the 70s.
When you work for this butcher shop that may have been run by Paul Castellano or owned by him, what were the rumors and what was any... Did that interest you at the time because you were interested in organized crime stories?
Yeah, it interested me enough, but not enough to ask any questions. I think I was a smart enough kid to just keep my eyes open and my mouth shut. You know, occasionally guys would come in and they'd say, take a walk. Guys in suits would come in and there was a big walk-in refrigerator in the back of the butcher shop, and they would go in there and have conversations, and that I, of course, was not privy to. And after, you know, 20 minutes or 30 minutes, they'd leave and I'd come back and continue to clean up. I also, when I was in college, I delivered the New York Times in the middle of the night. I was the guy at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, who, you know, with a massive paper route delivering the New York Times. And one of the areas in Brooklyn I delivered to was Mill Basin, which is a little enclave of expensive homes on the water, and home to a lot of doctors, lawyers, and allegedly mob figures as well. Sometimes when I would deliver the newspaper in the middle of the night, I would turn a corner and I'd see a car parked with its lights on, and I would come back because I didn't want to stumble on something I wasn't supposed to see, because, you know, a lot of innocent bystanders end up in trunks of cars with stuff like that. And I just, you know, just again, I think just from growing up there, you know what, if it doesn't concern you, don't ask, don't look, don't tell, just shut up and keep doing your job.
Martin Scorsese is an executive producer of Boardwalk Empire, and he directed the film that you wrote, The Wolf of Wall Street, and he directed the first episode, the pilot of Boardwalk Empire. I read that he screened gangster films of different eras for you and the other people working on Boardwalk Empire when you got to work on the series. What were some of the things Scorsese pointed out about some of the films that he screened that you hadn't noticed yourself that you found valuable as a writer and producer?
Well, first of all, that entire month of going to Martin Scorsese's office and watching gangster films with him was the best film course you've ever had, times a billion. It was just getting to sit with him watching Rod Steiger as Al Capone, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, you know, all these classic films, and hear his live commentary. He's very much about truth and real moments and real performances. You know, he understands the juxtaposition of violence and humor, or having an incredibly tense scene and then letting the air out of it, let the audience breathe with a light moment. Some of Martin Scorsese's films that are very violent, Goodfellas, for example, Raging Bull at times, can be very funny. I mean, these guys are so absurd in some ways that you almost can't help but laugh at them. And I think The Sopranos was like that too. It was often very funny. I think a lot of times when we would write scripts on The Sopranos, we would compliment each other by saying how funny your script was, not how dramatic or how poignant. It was, God, your script was so funny.
Terrence Winter will be back in the second half of the show. He's the creator and showrunner of HBO's Prohibition-era series Boardwalk Empire. The fifth and final season started last Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from PBS, with The Roosevelts, An Intimate History by Ken Burns, chronicling the lives of Theodore, Franklin, and Eleanor, Sunday night at 8 Eastern. From Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. And from Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. This is NPR.
Coming up, from the new adventures of Flipper to The Sopranos, we talk with Terrence Winter about his writing career, which also includes doing the screenplay for The Wolf of Wall Street. His HBO series Boardwalk Empire just started its final season. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new fantasy novel The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell, who also wrote Cloud Atlas. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Terrence Winter, the creator and showrunner of HBO's series Boardwalk Empire. It's set in Atlantic City during Prohibition. The fifth and final season started last Sunday. Winter also worked on The Sopranos as a writer and executive producer. Several of the episodes he wrote became classics, including The Pine Barrens and the one in which Silvio kills Adriana. Winter wrote the screenplay for The Wolf of Wall Street, which was directed by Martin Scorsese, who was also an executive producer of Boardwalk Empire. When you were on our show, when Boardwalk Empire was just starting, and you spoke to our TV critic, David Bianculli, you told him that to get started in television, you lied a little bit, you didn't have an agent, and you realized you needed one to send people your scripts. So you found a former classmate from law school who had just become an agent, but really wasn't one yet. He wasn't really practicing. So you created a fake agency, a fake address, fake stationery. You pretended to be the agency's delivery boy and dropped off a lot of scripts. And it worked. That's how you got your first job. And were there other times that you so creatively got around obstacles?
Yeah, even getting into NYU, I had grown up in Brooklyn and went to a trade high school where I studied to be an auto mechanic. And I was to say that I was not prepared for college is kind of the understatement of the century. And this is the God's honest truth. In my senior year of high school in 1977 into 78, we read Death of a Salesman from September until June. And I'm not kidding. That was senior English in William E. Grady High School in Brooklyn in 1978. The city was near bankruptcy. It was a city school. That was it. That was all I read in high school in my senior year. So a couple of years later when I decided I needed to go to college, I was sort of stumbling around Greenwich Village and walked onto the campus of NYU. And without any further knowledge or preparation, I decided, well, this looks like a good college. I'll go here. I went in, got the brochure, read it, and it became very apparent to me that I was not going to get into NYU with my vast knowledge of Death of a Salesman. But my instinct was, okay, how do I make this work? How do I figure this out? So at the time, NYU had offered a major in medieval history, or I'm not sure if it was medieval history or medieval religion. I do remember there was a religious component to it, and I said, all right, well, if I pick this major, I'll eliminate 95% of my competition who are putting down pre-law, pre-med. Let me pick something no one wants and see what happens. So I got a call a couple of weeks later from somebody there and said, so you have an auto mechanics license and you want to study medieval history. How did that happen? And I said, yeah, I think that's something I'd really like to study. And the guy was like, okay, that's very interesting. And suddenly I got a letter in the mail saying I was accepted to NYU provisionally. I was admitted as an adult student because I was ancient. I was 19 at that point, where everybody else was 17. And I worked full-time during the day and went to school full-time at night, and then vice versa. My last 2 years of college were spent as a doorman on the midnight to eight shift at a building on the Upper East Side. And I went to school full-time during the day and just powered through it.
Did you stick with medieval history?
No, I actually got a call from a dean a couple of years in saying, you know, you realize you haven't taken one medieval history class yet? I said, really? I said, wow, I think I'm going to change my major. Having grown up in Brooklyn in a, fairly working class environment, I knew cops and firemen and nurses and plumbers and guys who own butcher shops. You know, the important jobs I knew were doctor and lawyer. Those were the only two. So for an ambitious kid, I thought, all right, well, I want to make a lot of money. I'll be a lawyer. And I set my sights on that, even though I did like to write and actually had a journalism professor who alternately wrote me a recommendation letter for law school and then a side letter begging me not to go to law school and to pursue writing. And I thought, well, that's great. And I investigated the job opportunities at the Associated Press where he worked and discovered that an entry-level position paid half of what I was making at the time as a doorman. And I thought, well, this is crazy. I went to college and I'm at the time $40,000 in debt from student loans, and I'm going to take a job that gives me a 50% pay cut from my doorman job? Forget it. This is ridiculous. I'm going to law school. I did that. I ended up going to law school at night, worked for Merrill Lynch during the day, which was great training for writing The Wolf of Wall Street years later. Graduated from law school and then was absolutely miserable for 2 years. And at that point, I finally had the courage to confront my true self and say, what is it you want to do when you wake up in the morning? Forget about the money and the perceived respect that you're getting as a lawyer. How would you like to spend your day? And the answer was I wanted to be a writer.
And so you knew you wanted to write for television?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be a screenwriter, but the thing I could get my head around at the time was writing a half-hour sitcom. I couldn't imagine writing something that played out over 2 hours. It just felt so daunting.
Well, one of the sitcoms you wrote for early in your career was The New Adventures of Flipper.
Yeah, that wasn't actually a sitcom, although it was a comedy inadvertently. It was a one-hour drama.
Oh, it was a drama. I never saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you.
I always assumed there was comedy in it. Was it just heartwarming or in drama?
Heartwarming with quotes, I guess. It was a very light family fare. Have you seen the old Adventures of Flipper?
No, I never saw any of
the new Adventures.
Flipper
are not nearly as interesting. Flipper is a dolphin, of course, and the new Adventures of Flipper took place in Florida, if I'm remembering correctly, and it was about a marine biologist and a friend of his, and a lot of the stories involve the dolphin, which is extremely challenging because I think there are probably only 10 stories in the world that organically involve a dolphin. And when you have an episode order of 22, and once you get to the 10th one, it's really a lot of looking at each other across the table thinking, what do we do now? That was a hard job. That was tough. But at the time, I was thrilled to have any job. The fact that people would pay me to write something was I still can't get over how lucky I am.
Did writing for Flipper the Dolphin prepare you at all for writing for Tony Soprano?
It prepared me in the sense of you've got a job to do and you got to do it. So even when it's tough, you know, you've got a crew of people waiting for you who are waiting for you to finish your script. So I know you can't think of anything to say or have this dolphin do, but you better sit down and figure it out because that's your job. Some of the darkest moments I ever had as a writer were on Flipper. And actually, coincidentally, bringing up The Sopranos, my friend Frank Renzulli, who introduced me to David Chase several years later, he and I were talking, and it was a holiday weekend, and I was supposed to write a Flipper episode, and I could not think of – I just couldn't do it. I mean, I took this job just because I wanted the job. And not because there was anything about the show that interested me. And it was the holiday weekend, and I just ground to a halt. And I don't really suffer from writer's block, and I don't even know if this was writer's block. It was just – I just was paralyzed. And I called Frank, and I said, I can't do this. I have to quit this show. And he said, get a grip, go out for a walk, come back, sit down, and do your effing job. And I said, okay. And I came home an hour later, and I sat down, and I did it. And I called him up, and I said, thank you. Thanks for talking me off that ledge. You're absolutely right. And I said, I'm going to take you out to dinner when I'm done with this thing. And that's what we did.
And he's the guy who got you the job on The Sopranos later.
Yeah, he was one of the first people David hired on The Sopranos, David Chase hired on The Sopranos in season one. And I actually got my agent had sent me a video cassette, and dating myself, of The Sopranos pilot episode. And he said, just, I want you to watch this. And I said, The Sopranos, what is it, opera? Why me? He said, just watch it. And I think I was about 30 minutes into it, and I was trembling. I thought, I know these guys. I know how they talk. I know how they think. I know I can write this show. And as it turned out, Frank had already had a meeting set up with David Chase. And I said, you got to get me in there with you. He said, I'll do whatever I can. Frank was the last guy David hired for season one. And I sort of sat out on the sidelines during season one, you know, listening to the stories about how they were developing episodes. And Frank was actually sending me scenes, and I was proofreading his work. And so I sort of got to work on The Sopranos from home without David knowing it. And it wasn't until season two, David, a lot of the people who were on staff in the first season didn't survive till the second season. Frank was one of them, Robin Green and Mitch Burgess, of course. And finally, when season two started, David said, all right, who's this guy, Terry Winter? And I met David, and the rest is history.
Let's pause here and listen to a scene from an episode of The Sopranos that was written and directed by our guest, Terrence Winter. It's from the final season. Tony Soprano's teenage son, AJ, is very depressed because his girlfriend recently broke up with him. He's been kind of threatening suicide. Tony is worried and feels partly responsible for his son's depression. He explains why in a session with his therapist, Dr. Melfi, played by Lorraine Bracco. Tony, played by the late James Gandolfini, speaks first.
Obviously, I'm prone to depression. A certain bleak attitude about the world. But I know I can handle it. Your kids, though. It's like when they're little and they get sick. You'd give anything in the world to trade places with them so they don't have to suffer. And then to think you're the cause of it.
How are you the cause of it?
It's in his blood, this miserable existence. My rotten, putrid genes have infected my kid's soul. That's my gift to my son.
I know this is difficult. I'm very glad we're having this discussion.
Really? Really? Because I gotta be honest, I think it sucks.
What does?
Therapy. This. I hate the Seriously, we're both adults here, right? So, after all is said and done, after all the complaining and the crying and all the is this all there is?
We'll continue our interview with Terrence Winter after a break. He wrote for The Sopranos and is the creator of the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Terrence Winter. He's the creator and showrunner of Boardwalk Empire, which just started its fifth and final season on HBO. He was a writer for The Sopranos and also wrote the screenplay for The Wolf of Wall Street. Let's talk about The Wolf of Wall Street. Let's start with a clip. So Leonardo DiCaprio plays Jordan Belfort, who is a stockbroker, but then the company he works for is a victim of the crash of 1987. So he answers an ad for a broker, for a stockbroker, and shows up for his job interview at this storefront at a rundown strip mall. And, you know, this isn't really a legit brokerage house. It's a bunch of guys who know nothing about the markets trying to con people into buying really cheap stocks that are worthless and are going to basically stay worthless. But he's such a great salesman and con artist, and he's so unethical, that he just cold calls a potential buyer and lies, sells a lot of stock, makes a big commission. And in the middle of this spiel, everyone in the office stops working so they can listen to him make this phone call because he's just so good at it. Here's the scene, and the company that he's selling the stock of is called Aerodyne.
Hello, John. How are you doing today? You mailed in my company a postcard a few weeks back requesting information on penny stocks that had huge upside potential with very little downside risk. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah, I may have said.
Okay, great. Well, reason for the call today, John, is something just came across my desk, John. It is perhaps the best thing I've seen in the last 6 months. If you have 60 seconds, I'd like to share the idea with you. You got a minute? Name of the company, Aerodyne International. It is a cutting-edge, high-tech firm out of the Midwest awaiting imminent patent approval on a next generation of radar detectors that have both huge military and civilian applications. Now, right now, John, the stock trades over the counter at 10 cents a share. And by the way, John, our analyst indicator could go a heck of a lot higher than that. Your profit on a mere $6,000 investment would be upwards of $60,000.
Jesus, that's my mortgage, man.
Exactly. You could pay off your mortgage.
This stock will pay off my house.
John, one thing I can promise you, even in this market, is that I never ask my clients to judge me on my winners. I ask them to judge me on my losers because I have so few. And in the case of Aerodyne, based on every technical factor out there, John, we are looking at a grand slam home run.
Okay, let's do it. I'll do $4,000.
$4,000, that'd be 40,000 shares, John. Let me lock in that trade right now and get back to you with my secretary with an exact confirmation. Sound good, John?
Yeah, sounds good.
Great. Hey, John, thank you for your vote of confidence, and welcome to the Investor Center.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
How'd you do that?
Just like that, I made $2,000. The other guys looked at me like I just discovered fire.
Great. Even better.
I was selling garbage to garbage men and making cash hand over fist. The only problem you're going to have is that you didn't buy more.
Boom, shock.
So I was selling them.
Fuego.
The way I looked at it, their money was better off in my pocket. I knew how to spend it better.
So that's a scene from The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio, and my guest Terrence Winter wrote the screenplay. So what interested you in this story? It's based on a memoir.
Well, you know, it goes back to my interest in con men. You know, Jordan was a very slick salesperson. There's a lot in Jordan's life that was very similar to my own. We were basically the same age. He was a very ambitious young kid who was kind of a hustler who grew up in Bayside, Queens. I was that same kid in Brooklyn. He would sell Italian ices on the beach in the summer to make money. I was selling stuff. You know, I was, you know, you name the job, I did it as a teenager. Just very, both obsessed with becoming successful. We both worked on Wall Street a mile away from each other in 1987. The crash of 87 was the thing that spun me into a different direction, you know, becoming a lawyer and then ultimately going on to be a writer. That same crash sent Jordan out to Long Island to sell penny stock. That's where our paths diverged. But up until that point, there were a lot of similarities. And I felt like I really understood him. I understood that driving ambition and that willingness to cross lines in the sand, you know, maybe engage in things that were not quite ethical or half-truths, as long as the perception was you weren't really hurting anybody. And then, of course, in Jordan's life, those lines in the sand kept getting further and further out into the ocean until he was really hurting people and ultimately hurting himself and his family.
You wanted to be rich, but did you want the kind of excess that Jordan Belfort has in The Wolf of Wall Street? Just, you know.
No. I wanted to
the
be secure.
Jewels and mansions and cars and planes.
None of that stuff has ever been important to me. And I just was the security to do what I want to do in life and just know that my family is secure. And, you know, that's really all. That's really what I wanted. And I didn't know it at the time. I probably think I perceived that I wanted to be rich. And I was a kid, I used to walk around Kings Plaza, the shopping mall in Brooklyn.
Oh, God, I remember that place.
I used to walk through Macy's and look at all the fancy furniture and think, one day I'm going to have this. That was how I used to inspire myself. Mm-hmm. I would walk through those furniture departments and think, yeah, one day I'm going to have this, you know, oriental dining room set, and it's, well, that's going to be so cool. That was the stuff that sort of fueled my ambition. I lived in this tiny little house in Marine Park, and I remember the Franklin Mint used to do these mini ingots that they would advertise in the back of the Daily News magazine. And at 15 years old, I sent away for those ingots thinking, you know, when I'm a millionaire one day, I'm going to need stuff like this for my mansion. And I actually still have them. And I guess my millionaire friends will come over and we can look at my Franklin Mint ingot collection. And the funny thing is now, you know, in my house in L.A., when my friends come over, I do take out my ingots and say, you just have to let me live this fantasy out. Here are my mini art treasures of the Louvre, and they come with a little magnifying glass, and I am doing that, but not in the way I imagined it at 15.
Terrence Winter, it's been great to talk with you. Good luck with the final season of Boardwalk Empire, and congratulations.
Thank you. This was
a
lot of fun. Thank you for having me. This was really a lot of fun to do.
Terrence Winter is the creator and showrunner of HBO's Boardwalk Empire. The fifth and final season started last Sunday. We have an extra for you that there wasn't time for on the show. It's about how Terrence Winter wrote the scene in The Sopranos in which Silvio kills Adriana. You can hear that story on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/freshair. Coming up, our book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel by David Mitchell, who also wrote Cloud Atlas. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Novelist David Mitchell is the author of Cloud Atlas, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, and other novels containing multiple storylines that defy boundaries of time and genre. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Mitchell's latest, The Bone Clocks, is more of the same, but different.
David Mitchell is one of those writers I'd follow anywhere. even deep into what is, for me, the often exasperating genre of fantasy fiction. I don't naturally gravitate to tales about alternative universes, wormholes, or tribbles, but there are always exceptions. And if Mitchell feels like trying out a semi-futuristic vehicle about immortal soul stealers, I'm willing to take a deep breath, step aboard, and say, in the words of Rod Serling, next stop, the Twilight Zone. As in Cloud Atlas and some of his lesser-known novels, Mitchell's new book, called The Bone Clocks, is elaborately constructed, jumping around in time and narrative perspective. A friend of mine, who's also a Mitchell enthusiast, rightly says that his novels are postmodernists without all the pretentious metaphysics. What my friend means is that Mitchell's technical wizardry is there not for show, but in service to his themes and characters. He's a deeply compassionate writer. In fact, despite its experimental edge, the main reason to read The Bone Clocks is an old-fashioned one: the draw of a charismatic character named Holly Sykes. Holly opens and closes this 600-plus page odyssey into the dark side, which spans from 1984 to 2043. A self-involved and sex-addled 15-year-old, when we first meet her, Holly runs away from her working-class home in London after her mom forbids her to see her sleazy older boyfriend anymore. Appearing unannounced at the boyfriend's flat, Holly discovers him in bed with her best friend. What now? Mitchell vividly evokes the trapped worldview of a miserable adolescent desperate for a way out. A sniffling Holly takes to the road alone, where she becomes prime prey for a ghastly gang of mystics known as the Anchorites, who never die as long as they have fresh souls to swallow. What makes Holly such an appealing entree is the fact that she's gifted with what her Irish relatives call the second sight. Since early childhood, she's experienced visitations and heard disembodied voices that she calls the radio people. Fortunately, the Anchorites aren't the only supernatural travelers on the road with Holly, and in a bang-up teaser to the apocalyptic ending of this novel, Holly survives an attempted soul mugging intact with a little help from her spirit guardians. It's when she returns back to her family that Holly walks into another nightmare, one that reverberates throughout the rest of her life. Enough. It's impossible to summarize the plots of fantasy novels, even fine ones, without sounding like a Doctor Who-obsessed 12-year-old. Fortunately, beneath the big framework of his fantasy novel, the tireless Mitchell constructs other types of stories. A classic con artist tale narrated by a scholarship boy at Cambridge. A war dispatch told to us by a journalist who's addicted to the thrill of fear. And, naughtiest of all, an academic literary farce narrated by a bad boy British novelist who's bouncing from book festival to college visiting writer gig. The many narratives of The Bone Clocks are united by their unexpected links to Holly, as well as by their obsession with the theme of mortality. Here's a passage where the con artist college student experiences a vision of inevitable decrepitude in, of all places, a discotheque. Empires die, like all of us dancers in the strobe lit dark. Look, wrinkles spread like mildew over our peachy sheen. Varicose veins worm through plucked calves. DNA frays like wool, and down we tumble. A fall on the stairs, a heart attack, a stroke, not dancing but twitching. They knew it in the Middle Ages. Life is a terminal illness. In The Bone Clocks, a map of a labyrinth is Holly's only defense against annihilation. As a novel, The Bone Clocks itself is a labyrinth, offering readers not a defense against death, of course, but the chance to step out of time for a while and into a world richer and stranger than most of us could imagine.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University, and she's the author of the new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Sam Brigger. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross, closing today's show on this 13th anniversary of 9/11 with Charlie Hayden's recording of America the Beautiful from his 2002 album, American Dreams.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from eSurance, with an app that lets users manage their car insurance policies, update payment info, and handle claims at eSurance.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. And from Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson, in appreciation of NPR's lively coverage of culture and the arts. This is NPR.
Composer, band leader, and musician Gerald Wilson died Monday at the age of 96. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 2006 interview with him. Also, A. Scott Berg tells us why President Woodrow Wilson remains a divisive figure even though he left the White House in 1921. Berg's biography of Wilson is out in paperback. Join us.